This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends. With the head of the NHS Confederation saying this week that the health service is in a perilous state, you might want to recommend an episode from April asking, can the NHS survive?
There is a new common sense emerging about how the country should be run. And that's what's needed to replace the broken model forged by Margaret Thatcher many years ago.
Don't try and tell me that free markets are no longer fit for purpose. The free market and the values of freedom, equality, rights, responsibilities, and the rule of law that lie at its heart remains the greatest agent of collective human progress ever created.
An argument that has appeared settled for a couple of generations seems to have been opened again. But in 2017, what concretely is the contention between free market capitalism and socialism about? Step into the briefing room to find out. First, let's work out what is actually meant by the free market and look at its recent history. So, not since the Phoenicians, but since the war. Paul Johnson, director of the economic think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, visited the briefing room earlier to take us through it.
The free market doesn't sit there by itself. It is something that sits alongside the investments and the institutions that governments put there. A lot of the innovation that goes into your iPhone and so on comes from government-funded research. Much of the transport couldn't happen without the roads and the train lines that governments often put together, and with the legal institutions which are required to make the free market work. If we look at the UK since around 1945, the size and scope of government increased pretty dramatically. First, there was the significant expansion of the welfare state.
We've been steadily building up in this country what's come to be called the welfare state. The state that's concerned not with the ambitions of a ruling caste, but with the welfare of every individual human being in the community.
More state pensions, the NHS, of course. You also have the state moving into industry. So over the decades following the Second World War, we got the state taking over coal mining and increasingly for energy, water and local authorities building hundreds of thousands and over time millions of houses in the public sector. More things actually were brought into state ownership during the Labour government in the second half of the 1970s, bailing out the car industry, bailing out the shipbuilding industry, and so on.
As the gates of the gasworks clanged shut at 10:45, a great shout of triumph went up from a crowd of about 7,000 people.
We had terrible industrial relations, both in the public and in the private sector. It was that that brought down the Heath government. It wasn't actually state ownership. There was very poor economic growth and inflation, which brought the IMF in the late 1970s, not again specifically related to state ownership, but related to a very poor economic management of the economy. There was high level of state ownership of industry in the 1970s, and some of that was related to very poor performance in those parts of the economy. But there were other problems with the way that the economy was being managed as well, which lead us to remember the 1970s as a pretty grim period.
We are limiting the use of electricity by almost all factories, shops and offices to 3 days a week.
During the 1980s, there was a change in the consensus. Part of that consensus actually wasn't broken by Margaret Thatcher. So the continued growth in the size and the role of the National Health Service, the continued role of the state in providing pensions and education and so on, that didn't particularly change. But what did change was the role of the state in providing, for example, housing. So house building, public house building, pretty much came to an end in the 1980s. And the first big privatisation was actually the selling off of council houses.
Michael Heseltine has given to millions, yes, millions of council tenants the right to buy their own homes.
Mrs. Thatcher saw that the state shouldn't be there, in her view, running things like airlines, running things like coach companies. And initially, she sold some of those off and then gradually sold off some of the things that we economists think of as more like natural monopolies, things like water companies and electricity companies, which you clearly do need some state intervention in, if not to run them, then at least to regulate them. What you've clearly seen since then is very, very big increases in efficiency and in the performance of most of these industries. But that's much more closely related to the way in which competition has been enforced and the way in which regulation has been enforced than necessarily simply the issue of ownership.
I want Britain to be a country of enterprise and ambition. For business, this will be a government on your side, not in your way.
Tony Blair's government from 1997 onwards didn't dramatically change the economic policy that we saw over the 80s and 90s. He wasn't returning to significant state ownership. But one shouldn't take that too far, because clearly there were moves, other big changes, the introduction of the national minimum wage, for example, very big increases in tax credits and benefits for lower income people, an improvement in things like the competition regime, increased spending on things like the NHS and so on. So on the welfare side of things, it's a very big difference, a significant difference between Labour and what went before.
This is the day that the world came together to fight back against the global recession. Not with words, but with a plan for global recovery and for reform.
In 2008, there was a worldwide financial crisis which had an immediate and sharp impact on the British economy. This was the deepest recession that we've seen, certainly since the 1930s. So you've got this very big immediate financial crash with a recession, and the impact of the recession and that big fall in national income was a big hit to the public finances. So spending continued to rise, and as a fraction of national income, actually spending went back up to its 1970s level, went to very high levels historically, creating a great big deficit at its highest level since the Second World War. So you get to 2010, you've had a big recession, you've got a big deficit. What usually then happens is the economy starts to grow relatively strongly as you come out of recession and you kind of get back to normal. The problem with the last 6 or 7 years is that that hasn't happened. We've had very slow growth in incomes and in economic activity since 2010 relative to what we might reasonably have expected back then. And the result is that incomes, household incomes, are barely above where they were in 2008. Average earnings are actually below where they were in 2008. Now, we've actually never seen anything like that before. The governor of the Bank of England, thinks this might be the worst decade for earnings since the 1750s. Other people have said it's the worst since the Napoleonic Wars. Things were beginning to get better, it would seem, as we go through into 2015 and 2016. Wages were beginning to rise, inflation was under control. But from over the last year or so, things have been slightly going into reverse again. Inflation has been rising and wages haven't. The wealth, the pensions, the housing and the earnings of younger people have done really very, very badly relative to those of older people, meaning that for the first time, certainly in many, many decades, we're looking at a world in which the children of people who are currently 50 and 60 look like they may be worse off, certainly in the first decades of their adult life, than their parents were. But it is worth remembering that if you look at the period through the 50s and 60s and 70s, while the British economy was growing better than it has been over the last decade, it was doing dreadfully compared with most other developed economies. In the 1970s, the UK was known as the sick man of Europe because it was doing so badly. Through the next nearly 30 years, it was doing relatively well. The shock of the last 7 or 8 years is that after that period of relatively good economic times, we've had a very poor period in which people's incomes have simply not been growing. And that poor period has actually been worse, in absolute terms at least, than it was over the 60s and 70s, and actually a bit worse than it's been in most other countries since the recession.
Paul Johnson of the IFS. Paul mentioned the role of the 2008 financial crisis in creating today's economic climate. But how has that traumatic period changed the way we think about capitalism itself? Gillian Tett is US Managing Editor of the Financial Times and author of Fool's Gold, which looked at how the financial crash came about.
Well, I think we're still very much living with the shocks of the 2008 financial crisis, not simply because of the fact that it wiped out a lot of value from the stock market and people's houses for a period, although that's been partly reversed, but also because it shook people's confidence in the system. I mean, if you think about it, in the decades before 2008, most people in the West had not lived in a world where the pillars of the establishment suddenly and brutally collapsed, and where they were forced to question all kinds of basic assumptions about how their life worked. And essentially what the crisis did was to make the unthinkable entirely thinkable, force us all to think about six impossible things before breakfast, as Alice in Wonderland said. And what we've seen since then is that people have begun to question all kinds of other pillars of the modern world too.
Do you think that what happened in 2008 was fundamentally a failure of the market or a failure of government?
I think what happened in 2008 was fundamentally a failure of a system that was masquerading as a free market system, but in reality anything but free market. In some ways it was the worst of both worlds, in that it was neither properly free market nor government controlled, but fell somewhere in the middle. And by that I mean, if you go back to Adam Smith and look at his original vision of capitalism, this was founded on the idea that you had free markets with free access to prices. People could take part in the market if they wanted. You had some element of interest between owners and managers of companies, and you had a social context for markets and finance. And essentially all of those elements were missing in the City of London and Wall Street in the years before 2008, because you had big banks essentially doing things that were completely opaque to their shareholders, their supposed owners, and the rest of society. You had all these corners of finance which were almost not quite cartels, but were closed to outsiders, where no one knew what was going on. So that wasn't true free markets, and it wasn't government controlled either.
Do you think internationally capitalism is suffering from a crisis of legitimacy?
Well, it's very clear from the election results right across the Western world and from opinion polls is that there is a real crisis of legitimacy with the current economic system. You can argue whether what we have at the moment is really a proper market system, free market system or not, but it's clear that people are pretty disgusted by the way that many parts of it operate. Surveys suggest that a surprisingly large number of people in the US like the idea of socialism. They feel more positively about it than they do amongst the youth groups than capitalism. They may not understand what that means, but there's a generalized sense that actually The economic system has been serving a small proportion of the elite. It's not been benefiting people overall. And there's anger about it.
Insofar as we can kind of strip down what the alternatives are that people are gravitating towards, what is it that we can see?
I think that people are not clear what alternatives they're looking for. And one of the great disjunctures today is that people are increasingly living in a world where they customize almost every aspect of their lives, whether it's their music playlist, whether it's their clothes, whether it's their media, whether it's their friendship circles. And people are looking at politics these days and essentially trying to customize political choices in the sense of going for pick and mix politics. They're not signing up to entire party platforms. People are simply trying to express their protest by choosing alternative candidates.
This week, the IMF and World Bank are meeting. Now, is there any sense that they have the answers for reshaping capitalism?
There is a widespread recognition now amongst the people who are at the IMF and the World Bank and at meetings this week that after a decade of propping the system up with cheap money, there will have to be a reckoning eventually. And a decade ago, the big question was how to stop the entire system from imploding as an era of cheap private sector credit had pumped assets up to unsustainable levels. Now the question is, how do you remove the government stimulus, the quantitative easing, the super loose monetary policy, without causing the system to crash again?
So that's very much in the area of banking and so on. What about in the area actually of the free market itself and in the area of what belongs to the market and what belongs to the state?
Well, the good news is that there's growing recognition that free market capitalism will only work with a level of transparency that we've not seen before. There's a growing recognition that there needs to be more talk about long-term investing, not just short-term day trading or short-term investing. There's also recognition that perhaps it's time to start talking about stakeholders, not just shareholders. Those are all part of the conversation now. But what's very disappointing about the current political scene is that amid all the rise of these protest candidates, celebrity politicians, we've not really seen anybody outline a particularly credible or viable set of alternatives for revitalising capitalism. It's more a question of patching and mending.
Gillian Tett. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss the limitations and the roles of markets and the state are Professor Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge University, and Michael Jacobs, who works for the centre-left think tank the Institute for Public Policy Research. He co-edited a series of essays entitled Rethinking Capitalism. Helen Thompson, what do you think of the critique that you heard there from Gillian Tett that there's a big problem with international capitalism and the great minds of the system, the IMF, the World Bank and so on, really don't have a clear idea what to do about it?
I entirely agree with her. I think that what has happened since 2008 is essentially that the world's central banks, including the Chinese central bank, not just Western central banks, have kept capitalism functioning as it has been for the last 8-9 years or so, by pumping in lots of liquidity into the economic system via quantitative easing and extraordinarily low interest rates and a massive fiscal stimulus in the case of China. And that now they have essentially propped the system up, but they need to think about ways of withdrawing that liquidity, and they're absolutely clueless about how to do it. And so we're kind of left in some sense with a kind of almost like zombie version of capitalism that requires the central banks, but at the same time people understand that what they've done has created incredibly dangerous consequences that now have to be faced.
Right. Part of what we're talking about, Michael Jacobs, here is how to do the allocation, who does the allocation and so on. So is there anything, do you think, to be gained by switching the emphasis back to significantly stronger state intervention and regulation?
Yes, I do. In good times, when capitalism is working pretty well, then the private sector is capable, we've seen this historically, of investing in places that generate innovation, that generate new productivity improvements, create jobs and so on. But as we've been discussing, that hasn't been happening. So then who else can do it? There really is no other actor than the state. And the state is a very special kind of actor, partly because it has access to capital of its own. In the end, the state can borrow money very cheaply, particularly now, and it can create money, as it has been doing with quantitative easing. And it's also the only actor that, because it operates right across the economy, and because in most developed countries its own public finances are solvent, it can give confidence to the private sector. So I do think that at this point in history, as in the 1930s, and of course this is not new, the state needs to, in a sense, step in where private capital, private markets are not, and stimulate innovation, investment, and so on. And that is a role that only the state can do. And if it doesn't do it, we have what we have now, which is this kind of stagnation in the private sector.
So let's be concrete about that, Michael Jacobs. Where would you recommend now that the state in Britain, but maybe other places as well, steps in and takes action in a way that it hasn't done, let's say, for the last 30 or 40 years?
So in terms of the kinds of sectors, two areas stand out. The first of those is infrastructure, where we need new infrastructure in energy, in telecommunications and so on. And the second is in innovation. In all those companies that have got good ideas but are finding it difficult to raise the finance, we should be spending much more co-investing the public sector with the private sector in those sectors of the economy. And secondly, we should be doing this geographically. So one of the problems we have in the UK in particular is that we have an extremely unbalanced economy geographically. London and the South East is nearly now 40% of the whole UK economy. And there are parts of the economy in the North East, in Wales, parts of Scotland, Northern Ireland, North West, which are really not doing so well and are not getting the investment. So one of the things the state can do, governments can do, is to help direct investment into different geographical parts of the economy. And part of this is about public spending, but it's also about public banking. Many of the most successful economies in periods when they've been through recession or when they've been looking for industrial development have used state investment banks, so public investment banks, to invest where the private sector is nervous of doing so, usually with the private sector, not instead of.
Who's done that?
Germany has one of the most successful state investment banks, the KfW. South Korea has done this. China has obviously done this. Brazil, amongst the emerging economies. France has a state investment bank. And that enables capital to flow from the private sector because it gives confidence that the public sector is also investing.
Now, Helen Thompson, how do you react to his menu?
I think there's something to be said for it, but I think at the same time we've got to recognise that there are also unintended consequences, sometimes perhaps not so unintended consequences, to the state getting involved in decisions about the allocation of capital. One of the things that has a tendency to produce is what's often called crony capitalism, and that's one of the things that I think has undermined the whole functioning of capitalism even before we get to 2008, and that's the very cosy relationship between certain businesses and politicians.
OK, Michael Jacobs, let's boil this down to specifics and take one particular sector, housing. What could be done by the state in the housing market to completely change the situation?
State intervention works well, particularly when the absence of it is working really badly. In housing, the key problem is that private ownership of land is used as an investment asset, where what you get if you own land, and this is true of housing companies, but it's also true of individuals who use buy-to-let as a way of improving their net wealth. And so as long as housing land is a source of wealth, then it's good for homeowners and investors in property to see all those values rising, but then that puts it out of the reach of ordinary people and young people who want to get on the housing ladder and people who have to rent, because, of course, rents rise with property values. So that's why the state is important, because the state can do two things. It can plan the system to allow more houses to be built because it's in charge of the planning system. And secondly, it can buy land. And then because it doesn't need to make a big profit on it, it can make building happen on that land much more quickly.
Helen Thompson, what do you make of that in the context of the housing market?
I certainly agree that the state's got a part to play in increasing the number of houses built in this country. That's clearly a significant part of the problem. But another part of the problem goes back to this post-2008 monetary world, and that is that actual property is being used as an investment asset, and that the market in London and the South East in particular has become essentially, in part at least, a function of international capital flows. And that's a much, much harder problem to crack than dealing the state.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. You could prevent properties being sold abroad for investment. You could ensure that properties that were left empty were subjected to penal rates of tax and so on. That's where government, which acts, government is after all our collective voice, isn't it? It can act on behalf of the community as a whole to regulate markets that don't work for the community as a whole.
Helen Thompson, what about the arguments that surround things like utilities? And one of the major arguments which has come recently is that utilities like water and so on might actually be better off back in the public sector.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we can see here is, and I think this is one of the sort of confusions that was there in Theresa May's speech when she talked about defending free markets, is that when people look at the energy market and the provision of electricity and water, etc., what they don't see is a free market. What they look at it and they see is businesses acting more like a cartel. I certainly think the state's got a role to play in encouraging competition and breaking up that kind of cartel-like activity.
Michael Jacobs, Paul Johnson spoke earlier about a series of problems, particular problems in the economy, which are causing a loss of confidence, low wages, intergenerational inequality, low productivity, of course. In what way does altering a state-private sector balance help you with any of those things?
Well, so this is really important, that not all the problems are solved by one kind of activity. And the state's role in creating demand, in helping investment move into the areas that will increase innovation and productivity and so on, is not the be-all and end-all of economic policy. So we also need policies that help raise productivity in the private sector. So if you look at the reason why the UK has much lower productivity than our major comparator countries like France and Germany and the US, it's not because our best firms are less productive. They are absolutely as productive as the best in the world. It's because we have a lot of firms that are much less productive than in other countries. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. One of them appears to be that our management isn't quite as good if you look at management scores compared internationally. Another one is that
this feels like a very old argument, doesn't it?
But the fact that it's an old argument doesn't mean that it's not a correct one. But the other thing is that we have the most flexible labour market of all of our comparator countries. And in a very flexible labour market, what we know this as now is the gig economy, where you can employ somebody, an unskilled worker, by the hour. Companies don't have the incentive to invest in the machines and capital equipment, in the training, in the research, which will improve their productivity. So our very flexible labour market, which has good results in terms of employment, keeps productivity low, keeps earnings low. So we need to get out of that trap. Now, government has a role in that. It can regulate the labour market and so on, but we can also need to make sure that firms are better at it. So by no means is this all about the state taking over. The number of companies that the state might take over because it can run them better is tiny, 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 tiny. We need to get the private sector working better. And one of the things here is again, not about what the state does, but about the way companies are structured. So in the UK, we have a corporate governance model, that is how companies are governed, which gives all the rights of ownership and of control to the shareholders. Now, and those shareholders are increasingly investment funds, hedge funds and others, who, for whom the ownership of that company is about getting the most value out of those shares. So they focus on short-term improvements in the value of shares. Some of the trading in shares goes on in high-frequency trades with run by algorithms, not even people. And that creates pressures on companies to behave in much more short-termist ways because what their investors, their shareholders, want are short-term returns. These are things we can do to improve the way in which our companies work, and they're not the same in every other country. That's a really important lesson. The UK form of capitalism is not the only form of capitalism, and there are better forms out there.
Like?
Well, Germany being an example, where a group of shareholders tends to have a controlling ownership, or a Swedish model, where you have a much better relationship between unions and companies and so on. So there are different ways of organising companies and the labour market and so on in our economy, and this is not all about state ownership at all.
Alan Thompson, do you think that looking forward, given what's happening in terms of people's attitudes and also happening in the economy itself, that we could anticipate a rebalancing between the private sector and state intervention over the course of the next 5, 10, 15 years?
I think we are, because I think that both parties in different ways have, at least for the moment, being led by people who want the state in some sense to do more than has been the case for quite some time. But I think that the political demand for the state to do more is not going away. And partly that is because even regardless of the question whether the state can actually effectively do more or not, so long as we have these extremely difficult problems, then many people are going to be saying, well, let's give the state doing more a try.
To try and sum all that up, we've had a kind of settlement for the last few years that seems to have broken down. People don't think that the situation is sustainable as it has been. And one of the things that could well alter is the balance between state intervention and the free market. But to what degree, we don't know. My thanks to Paul Johnson, Gillian Tett, Helen Thompson and Michael Jacobs. We'll be back at the same time next week. Good night. The briefing room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.